Welcome back, folks, to episode 57 of the Running Man Self-Regulation Skills and Self-Improvement Project podcast with me, your host, Dr. Armando Dominguez, PhD in health psychology, licensed professional counselor, and an adjunct professor at a local community college. And what we're going to be discussing today is going to be almost a part two to the last episode, episode 56, about concept failure and application failure. So this really isn't truly part two, but will be an adjunct and will help us understand a little more in the realm of self-regulation skills when I'm learning them to overcome those things that are difficult, such as mood and outbursts and this sort of stuff that may be uncontrollable when things happen suddenly and I feel overwhelmed. Also, whenever I might have anxiety or have a sense of overwhelm such that I feel like I can't manage what's happening in not only my physical environment, but also my mental, emotional environment. And the information I'm going to share with you today has been around for a little bit, since about 2012. There was a grant provided to the National Institute of Health in 2012 that was having to do with self-regulatory skills and what happens in the brain, the structures in the brain, and also where the metabolism of sugar happened while the process of self-regulation was being applied. But in addition to that, what it was is specifically within the field of cognitive neuroscience. And this is something that's really helpful, not just to the people that struggle with stress, but also those people on the helper side of the desk, wherever we're talking about clinicians, doctors, also counselors such as myself and social workers, whenever we're trying to help, because we are dealing with a human-to-human interaction. That's one thing that we tend to forget, because we get really high-minded about the fact that maybe I'm a professional, semi-professional, and I'm helping patients, or patients get a little high-minded in the sense that unless you have certain qualifications and or maybe they consider you not qualified because of lack of training, that somehow they're out of the realm of help and you don't understand. Now, that was a big, hairy run-on sentence, and my English teacher would probably not be really happy with me, bless her heart. But the reason I stated it that way is that it's all very connected. And there's a point to what I do. Rarely do I do anything by accident. Accidents do happen once in a while. And what I tell you is that whenever I say or do something, generally it is with a point behind it, with an indicator of direction relative to the education so we can move forward and get better as a result. So what we're going to touch upon right now is what was studied in that very nicely done study with the National Institute of Health, having to do with, once again, cognitive neuroscience and what happens to us whenever we're trying to self-regulate and learn self-regulatory skills. Some of the structures that were noted were the prefrontal cortex. It has to do with the frontal part of our brain, the higher part of our brain, and that's also known as the neocortex, having to do with the neocortical structures, the higher structures that have to do with our ABCs, our 1, 2, 3s, also with memory and recall, but not only that, but in the social sense, it also provides us what we would call our breaks or our filters that would allow us to note what would be considered socially appropriate, things that we learn to be socially appropriate, because when we're under age two, most of us were unsocialized little savages. I love that term. But at the same time, I say it jokingly because we're in the process of learning how to become socialized to our groups, our tribes, our villagers, our families, homes, jobs, this sort of stuff over time. But also, these are the times that we have to learn to actually not only access those areas of self-regulation and self-control, but also when to use those. Now, this is all a very well-known thing, and the understanding of this generally goes unspoken, but I'm the one that's going to speak it, because there are a lot of times we run around with these assumptions, assuming that we have learned, assuming that we have gotten those opportunities to gain those skills, and some of us may not have. So to think very clearly and very distinctly is a good thing, but more specifically and categorically is to realize that there are some people that have and haven't and have only gotten marginalized bits and pieces of what would be the opportunity to learn certain self-regulatory skills, especially the emotional, mental self-regulation, in addition to the behavioral as a result when the mental, emotional gets much too intense. So here we go. This is going to be the beginnings of self-regulatory skill building process as it occurs within us, not only in our brain, but also in our environment when we're learning the social skills, whether it be from family or whomever it is that we're learning behaviors from. Just like we learn language, we can say that we largely, by learning and by observation rather, vicarious learning, Albert Bandura's studies covering this, very profound studies indeed, but really laid down some foundation as to understanding how we learn language, how we learn behaviors, and much of it is by watching other people, those other people being our family or those closest to us, most frequently seen by us, and even those that we may go to school with, and then we come home and get in trouble with mom and dad, because where'd you learn that word, or where'd you learn how to do that? And questioning and knowing that, well, those things don't occur in our household. Where did you get that? And I remember being a child, being parented, and saying things, and my parents were like, where did you learn that? And usually it wasn't that polite, more abrupt. But these things occur because we are vicarious learners. We are primarily observational learners, unless, and this is visual, assuming we're not congenitally blind or have some limitation to our sight, which is, it's no disrespect to mention that, but just an identifier, calibrating the fact that that can actually impact what it is that would be our learning options that we would have available. But whenever we're thinking about the development of skills, self-regulatory skills, there is a component in our higher cortex and our dorsal lateral structures that's going to be more towards the back and to the sides of the brain, so to speak, if you want to look at the anatomical structures that activate whenever we're learning the self-regulatory and social filters of sorts having to do with not only with language but behaviors as well. It's not just the higher cortical but also the motor learning aspects that will allow us to regulate when we touch, don't touch, reach, don't reach, as much as think, don't think, certain things or say certain things in certain contexts. So there's a very, indeed, I would say, higher thinking, reasoning, rationale process that kicks in after the fact when we get older. But we have to understand that most of these behaviors that we're measuring and managing and controlling stem from the deeper subcortical structures that come from the cerebellar areas and the emotional areas that will motivate or demotivate us to do or not to do. Subcortical, when we're talking about motor learning, we do have some higher cortical structures that are involved with that for the voluntary motor stuff that we do. But whenever we're talking about the subcortical closer to the autonomic reflexive, there are things that will occur whenever under the right measure of stress that will override our best thinking. So whenever learning self-regulatory skills, we're assuming two things. One is that we're in a safe environment, and two, that our perception of that safe environment, this is an important one, our assumption of safety within that safe environment, in quotes, is met, and therefore I am at my fullest prefrontal cortical capacity to be able to make sense of what I'm learning and be able to follow along with it such that learning can occur in a relatively safe environment. Learning happens better and turns into long-term work and memory more effectively whenever we're happy campers for the most part. And that's a very important thing. Now, one thing that I will note is that whenever we are under stress, and let's say we're learning in a stressful environment, we do learn things very quickly. But there's also a very heavy emotional load that may parallel the experience of learning said skills. So it may tie certain emotional thoughts and remembrances that may either limit or actually motivate those actions to be a little more intense, a little stronger. And maybe whenever we do things, we may not enjoy them as much, especially if it's a behavior that is neutral and not tied to a self-defense situation, for instance. But whenever we're thinking about just base motor learning, being able to repeat a behavior, a physical skill that requires practice and time, we have to understand that there is also a neuroplastic effect. That means that our neuronal structures are being affected. We're eliciting signal through those neuronal structures, and we're synapsing, connecting as we're doing that. But whenever we have that emotional load, that can also tie those things to traumatic recall, emotional recall. So keep that in mind when we're thinking about this. But for now, whenever we're learning self-regulatory skills, often it is a very academic, higher-minded, reasonable, rational approach to fixing things that happen whenever things aren't reasonable nor rational, possibly dangerous, or I may feel that I may be in danger or at some sort of risk. So it's a far reach to be able to say, here, read this. This is what you do whenever the proverbial feces hits the fan, and then to expect somebody to do that. And it's unreasonable to expect somebody to say, I learned this and it worked, whenever it was the worst of worst things. And I'm not saying it can happen, but it's very unlikely to happen without some sort of practice, not unlike when we go to soccer practice, football practice, baseball practice. We are learning basic skills isolated on a mound, learning how to pitch, learning how to catch, for instance, in baseball. But also over time, you start pressure testing. You start increasing the level of stress and pressure and expectation, but not right away, not to its fullest, or then you'll derail not only the learning, but may also derail a person's ability to want to learn said skills. So once again, we learn better when we're happy campers, and I take that as a quote from Dr. Glenn Morris, the late Dr. Glenn J. Morris, that wrote some of the finest books I've ever read in my life. But the term happy camper, meaning generally enjoying the learning process, it's a very important thing. So we'll keep that on the back burner for now, and it's something that's helpful in learning any skill, much less self-regulatory skills, but it becomes very crucial when learning self-regulatory skills because they're so vital to us becoming more flexible and adaptable in responses to environments that are very stressful or potentially dangerous. So let's shift gears a little bit. So what happens when we're actually learning self-regulatory skills? According to the PET scans, they were noting where the metabolizing of sugars in the blood within the brain itself were happening more effectively at a higher rate versus other areas whenever we were learning self-regulatory skills or when we were remembering things that were maybe a little more negative and trying to apply the new self-regulation behavior or thought pattern, this sort of thing. So most definitely there was activity in the areas that they were hoping. Mostly it was in the prefrontal cortical structure that was in recall of maybe an event that was negative and then trying to not become triggered by said emotion or memory. Now, this just means that they were doing this in a safe setting and also that the blood flow was occurring just by imagination alone, just by the recall alone versus actually being in it. And that was to be expected. Now, what was also noted by fMRI is realizing what structures were lighting up and the differences before and after when learning self-regulatory skills. Whenever they realized in the study that, yes, there was metabolizing of blood sugars in the noted areas having to do with the prefrontal cortex and learning self-regulatory skills, but they also noted that in the nucleus accumbens, and not unlike the amygdala that we do know, actually increases in size because of the activity, there are more synaptic responses occurring. So we have neuronal growth. This is the neuroplasticity thing. So that means that our brain actually physically, not just in a conceptual sense, changes in addition to our ability to cognitively hold certain ideas as being useful. It's no longer just a subjective thing, but we're having an objective change as a result of shifting the way we think about things and the way we may try to address them beforehand. In expectation, that predictive mind machine we talked about, in expectation of something that could occur that could be stressful, that would require these self-regulatory skills. So the self-regulation skills, just like any physical motor skill, require repetition and practice. And over time, with a little pressure testing and a little repetition, we become very good at it. Now, just as a parallel idea, whenever we learn how to ride a bike, many people speak the adage of it's just like riding a bike. And you remember it once you get back on it. You may lose some of the refinement. You may know how to ride the bike and turn the handlebars and pedal at the same time and coordinate, and you can get smooth. But you're not as smooth at first blush whenever you get back on the bike after maybe 10 or 12 years of not riding a bike, but you remember how. But it also comes back rather quickly, and then once you condition to it, you realize, wow, this won't take long. It might take you a little more time to recover from having sore legs, but you'll remember how to do it because the body remembers. Now, whenever we are learning self-regulatory skills, not so different, there is a practice quality. Just like whenever we have motor skill learning, we always talk about how we have muscle memory. Well, in fact, we do have certain pathways that recede a little bit whenever we don't do certain things. In the lines of addiction science, in particular, addiction to substances and or behaviors, process behaviors, and things that require something external to get a payoff, some release of dopamine, for instance, or wherever we start using things excessively to make ourselves feel good that are external to us, those pathways get extra support. But we also know that synapses recede when they're not being used. We know that there's certain ones that will grow if we continue to use them. So the more practice you have doing a certain behavior, yes, they get stronger, they get better. In other words, by default, we become more skillful. Even those things that we would consider addictions, if we really look at it through the lens of having repeated a behavior to the point of skillfulness, such that it is now a no-thought behavior, it becomes second nature. Now we have a fight on our hands if we're trying to stop those behaviors, especially if they're unhealthy for us. So whenever we're thinking about this, anything that we repeat, once again, anything that we repeat will create neuroplastic response, and we'll have synapsing, we'll have extra connections growing in support of those areas. Not only the primary is being used, but also secondary. So that way, if something happens to the primary, you still kind of are able to do those things. And it becomes almost a holographic effect in the sense that you have lower quality copies of those memories in other areas than just in the areas involved. So it's almost like a bad copy of a copy. If you copy enough, it's still going to be quality enough that you can identify it or for it to fire. But they're backups, and we have backups in our brain in that sense. So if something is repeated often enough, that means our body responds and adapts in the sense that it has prioritized it. So what are the behaviors that I prioritize? If I get angry a lot without regulation, what is the body prioritizing? Is it the anger or the stopping of that anger? Because if you're having anger, that's a survival response. It's a secondary emotion. What might be driving it may be very much a priority and very serious. But if we're not adding a self-regulatory attempt within the realm of having those experiences, then it's going to be the emotional load and the expression of that that becomes prioritized, not the stopping of it or the regulation of it. And if you do it often enough, that priority is going to be occupying much of what we will call a regular responses. And this is where, in the clinical setting, I've heard people complain about having anger outbursts and not being able to control themselves. And that is not dishonesty on their part, or maybe giving themselves an out and letting themselves off the hook. You practice often enough, things happen fast enough and with enough intensity. We're talking about a second nature of the response. When things become that natural, they become difficult to stop. So it is not a lack of moral nor lack of ethical necessarily anything that would prevent us from doing that, even though there may be a lack in those two areas. But fundamentally speaking, as the response occurs, if it's fast enough, just like when somebody tosses a ball at your face and your hand goes up before you can even think about it and stops the ball before it hits you in the face, well, that is what we're talking about. Same thing kind of happens with emotions and even our knee-jerk thought processes. Whenever we have an emotional response, we're responding from the subcortical bottom-up areas, from the emotional and also from the intense primal Paleolithic areas of our brain that are better for survival in harsher settings than in the socialized appropriate settings, wherever we follow guidelines and rules that are really just social agreements. There's no anything that even exists that we would call a law other than the words and the books that we guide and support and remember by. But there isn't anything that tells you treat people nice or makes you treat people nice. We just know that at some point, these things actually grease the wheels of human interaction, make things smoother, but also it helps us to get along when we're trying to get along, to get more of what we need and be able to allow other people to get what they need and to be able to work more collaboratively and cooperatively together. Now, self-regulation skill is, not unlike motor skill, a skill, and there is a learning curve and there is time involved. You can read all the books you want about self-regulation and how to stop anger and how to curb those things that we experience, such as depression. But you have to practice the skills, the breathing that works to help dysregulate the anxiety, so to speak, to stop it in its tracks, requires that you repeat it and use it whenever it's low stakes, whenever it's not high pressure. Don't try to apply them only when it's high pressure. Apply them when it's low stakes, when you're in a better state, so you can encourage the synapsing and the growth of the neurological structure so that whenever you try to do it under stress, it does become easier because you now have some skill behind it. It's not like somebody's thrusting something at you and saying, here, do this, and you've never done before. Well, what do you do with it? You may be holding something upside down and realizing, well, I don't know what I'm looking at. And not unlike that, our self-regulatory skills can seem unfamiliar in ground that seems way too familiar whenever we may dysregulate, get upset, get angry, depressed, anxious. But yet, this new thing that you're throwing in there, I don't know what to do with it or where to put it. And that's okay. But if we recognize that we're the best learners when we're happy campers, learn to use these skills when it's low stakes. Build skill with them over time. And whenever the time comes, if the time comes, hopefully it won't, that is stressful or tense or even a threatening event, you'll know that you'll have skill and have more wherewithal with which to do, whether it be a breathing exercise, be willing to get up to physically move away from an event or an area that may be causing anxiety, and realizing that you are not obligated to sit or stay there, and you are obligated to make sure that you feel safe, and that may include just walking away. Simple things seem very difficult whenever we have these social schemes that are overlaid that make us feel like if I walk away, someone's going to call me a coward or a weenie or something like that. And those are just words. The reality is if your heart rate's up and your breathing is changing because your body feels like it's exercising, you're trying to sit still, you're probably not doing yourself a big favor. So what I'm trying to encourage here is repetition of self-regulatory skills, learning them when it's easy, taking time to do those things. You don't have to tell anybody you're doing this. They're kind of ninja that way. Just practice them so that way you get better when things are stressful, so that way when they are stressful, you come out feeling better and knowing better. But not only that, but doing better in a sense that you'll allow yourself more options and you'll be less apt to put your choices in someone else's hands and feel like someone else is controlling your life when in actuality, you have all the control. It's in your hands. So for now, thank you for listening today. Certainly been good talking to you. And I'd like to say that the podcast is global and it's all on all the major platforms. We do have it loaded on YouTube as well. And we're continuing to grow throughout the platforms. And I appreciate your all's attention. And please share this with anyone you think may benefit from it. And if you know somebody that won't, give it to them anyway. And that's okay. You can blame it on me. But if you'd like to reach out and send me an email, send it to the email at runningmangetskillsproject@gmail. And I'd be happy to respond to you. And it's certainly good talking to you. Take care. All the best. Walk well.